Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we're going to be talking with Janina Scarlett. We're talking about her book, Superhero Therapy. Welcome, Janina.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Sherry.
Thank you for coming on the show. Why don't you tell a little bit about your background and how you came up with superhero therapy?
Sure. I was born in Ukraine. I was exposed to Chernobyl radiation growing up. My family and I were able to immigrate to the United States as refugees. And later, when I got my doctorate in first neuroscience and then clinical psychology, I started working with active duty service members with PTSD who really enjoyed talking about superheroes and fictional characters. So I started incorporating superheroes and fictional characters in therapy, and from that, superhero therapy was born.
And exactly how do you incorporate the superheroes into therapy, and where did you get that idea?
So superhero therapy does not mean that only superheroes are incorporated. Superhero therapy means that the patient will learn to become his or her own version of a superhero. I do incorporate superheroes, traditional superheroes like Batman and Wonder Woman, for example, but I also incorporate other works of fiction like Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings. The way that it was developed is when I was working with active duty Marines, a lot of them kept bringing up Superman specifically and saying that they wanted to be like Superman, they wished they could be like Superman. Many of them saying, I wanted to be Superman, I failed. And where that came from is that many of them believed that because they developed a mental health disorder, like PTSD, for example, that somehow meant that they were not a superhero. So this is when I started asking, does Superman have any kind of vulnerability? And of course he does. Superman has that vulnerability to kryptonite. And then I would ask, does this make Superman any less of a superhero? And, of course, the answer is no. And, in fact, every superhero, every fictional character, and every live person has strengths, and they also have vulnerabilities, which I argue are a different division of strengths as well. And so through that, we were able to determine that these individuals can both have vulnerabilities and be heroes.
That's interesting. So How is a weakness a strength?
So vulnerability, I don't conceptualize it as a weakness. And in fact, some of the modern sciences are supporting that. Vulnerability appears to be the most courageous thing of which human beings are capable of. The definition of courage is not being fearless. The definition of courage is being afraid, but doing what's important anyway. So, for instance, a lot of the Marines that I was working with would come back from Afghanistan or Iraq deployments, and they would tell me that despite all the atrocities that they saw on their deployments, talking to a therapist was the most vulnerable and also the scariest thing they've ever done, because this is when they had to face all of their trauma. And yet they continued, they persevered, and they kept doing it anyway. And this, for the people that stayed in treatment, allowed them to eventually get better. So we're seeing a lot of research coming out right now that the way that we heal physically and emotionally is by allowing ourselves to be vulnerable. I mean, if you think about it, a person going through cancer has to be vulnerable by allowing doctors to operate on them. They have to literally allow themselves to be exposed, to be wounded physically in order to heal, in order to get the cancer out. The definition of vulnerable literally translates as woundable, being open to being hurt. And similarly, in a psychological sense, if we are completely closed down, if we're not willing to experience our emotions, we're more likely to develop psychological disorders like depression, like substance use, like anxiety. In fact, a lot of panic disorders come from an unwillingness to experience difficult emotions. And on the other hand, when we're willing to open up and experience these emotions, we're likely to process them, and then we're likely to heal.
That's very interesting. I want to talk about a little bit lighter. You obviously know about superheroes. Did you grow up watching that, was that something you were exposed to because you were in the therapy and they brought it up and then you did some research? I mean, how did you come to, other than the people that are coming to you talking about it, do you have your own superheroes that you like, and do you watch them? Do you watch the movies and animated films?
I do. I did not grow up with superheroes. I grew up in Ukraine, and we didn't have superheroes. We didn't have superhero comics or movies when I was growing up. Now, superheroes are universal, of course. But back then, I did not grow up on superheroes. And when I came to this country, a lot of people did not know what radiation exposure was. So I was in seventh grade, and I was kind of that freak that was exposed to radiation, so I was bullied. And a lot of kids would ask me if I'm contagious, if I'm radioactive, if I glow in the dark. So there was no understanding about what I was going through and what it meant to have genetic mutations. And as a result of being exposed to radiation, I do have certain physical differences and difficulties. So it wasn't until a few years later that I saw the first X-Men movie that completely changed my life, because X-Men are a group of genetic mutants, so they all have some kind of a mutation. Most of them have been exposed to radiation exposure of some kind, and they use this difference, they use this mutation to make a difference. They use this mutation to be heroes, to help other people. And my favorite superhero of all time is Storm. So Storm she's one of the X-Men. She was, when she was a little child, she and her parents were in a house that was, a plane landed on this house, crushing her parents to death, and little Aurora Monroe, which is Storm's real name, barely crawled out of it, and since then developed severe claustrophobia. And it was through her connection with nature and through her connection with the weather that she was able to heal and gain her powers, and then later join the X-Men and help them. But every once in a while, her claustrophobia and her trauma history still shows up and still affects her. So for me, with my radiation experience, the weather has a serious effect on me, and that's when my health condition gets worse. So it was really inspiring to see someone who was also a mutant, who also had this connection with the weather, but she used it to make a difference for the better. And I think this was the first time that instead of seeing myself as a victim, I saw myself as a survivor. And I thought, what if I used my differences to help other people as well? And so from then I started thinking about implementing fictional stories to try to better understand mental health. But I don't think I quite fully knew what I wanted to do with it professionally until I started working with active duty Marines.
That's fascinating. Do you hear of a science fiction writer called A. Van Vogt?
Can you say that one more time?
A. E. Van Vogt.
I have not.
He wrote a book called Slant. It's the first science fiction. My dad wanted me to start reading science fiction, and I was kind of scared of it because all I ever saw of it was a bug-eyed monster. So I really was kind of like tentative. So he gave me this book called Slant, which is what he called gentle, positive science fiction. And in the book, it's about the next generation of humans and how they are being persecuted, but they are really normal people that just have certain psychic powers, and they have certain mm-hmm. physical attributes that are different. It just reminded me of what you were talking about. It's a really beautiful story. If you've never read it, I really highly recommend it. Just letting you
wonderful.
Know.
Thank you. That sounds fascinating.
It's a really good book. It's very, very short. It's more of a novella, but it's one of my favorites.
Oh, it sounds lovely. Like, thank you. I'll check it out.
Yeah, and you just reminded me of it.
Well, thank you for that.
Do you read science fiction, or is that one of your interests?
I do read science fiction. I read more fantasy than science fiction, but I like all kinds of books. I like fiction and nonfiction. Within fiction, I tend to prefer fantasy, but I love books in general.
Yeah, I'm a bookworm, always have been. You mentioned Harry Potter. Is Harry Potter somebody who's popular in therapy? Well, my favorite's Hermione, but is Harry Potter's books popular for therapy? Or
yes, absolutely. I actually have the Sorcerer's Stone right next to me right now as a reference guide. Yes, a lot of my patients really, really like Harry Potter, and we use a lot of psychological examples from Harry Potter in therapy.
Yeah, she is. She has a lot in her books. I mean, there's a lot of overcoming weakness vulnerabilities and overcoming trauma, and it's like constant. The best example of it is Neville.
Right.
I mean, the man became the hero at the end. I mean, he was the most vulnerable member of the Harry Potter group. I mean,
yeah.
And he shining kills the example.
Last, yep, and he destroys the last Horcrux.
Yeah. Yeah. And helps and saves Harry.
Yes.
I mean, it's just yeah, I mean, he's really amazing. He's one of my favorite characters. I also find it fascinating how she doesn't make anybody lack. Even Voldemort has his vulnerabilities and his origins of why he became the evil Dark Lord.
Right.
When you read the series, did you were you surprised, or did you connect to it, or how did you feel about that?
I did. I did connect to it. I really appreciated that Rowling gave Voldemort such a developed background to show us that he's not just evil for the sake of being evil. He was born from a love potion to, you know, a woman that had a really difficult time understanding what love is, and to a man that didn't really experience love. So, of course, it makes sense that Voldemort himself, being the product of this, had no concept of love and no capability of empathy. And we know this, individuals with what's called antisocial personality disorder, who are in a lot of ways very similar to Voldemort, they're sometimes called sociopaths on television. So these individuals are biologically, not only psychologically, but biologically incapable of empathy because of the way their alleles form back in development stages. So these individuals don't quite have the same empathic response. Their neurons don't respond the same way as other people's neurons would.
Really? So if
yes.
you were, if there was no love in your conception, that can have a real impact on you as a child and an adult and your whole psychological background.
No, I'm sorry. That's not what I'm suggesting.
I'm sorry. I was like, freaking out in that one.
No, I'm sorry. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if during the child's development in embryo, the child's alleles don't line up correctly, so if their genetic code basically doesn't code a specific way, then it might sometimes basically short circuit. So what happens in individuals with kind of empathy deficit, if you will, so let me back up a little bit. In our brain, our neurons, our nerve cells, can respond by detecting what other people are doing and basically making us imagine how we would feel if we were in their shoes. So these neurons that do that are called mirror neurons. So they mirror what the other person is doing. So, for example, if you see somebody eating a lemon, you might feel a sour taste in your mouth. Similarly, if you see someone crying, you too might feel sad. So these mirror neurons are making you see what someone else is doing and making you experience similar sensory sensations as the other individual, and that's how empathy develops. Now, if in embryo stages there was the allele alignment, so in the genetic code, if something went wrong, then one of the many possibilities of what could go wrong is the development of these mirror neurons, and therefore they might misfire, and this individual might therefore not understand how other people feel, and therefore might be incapable of being empathic to other individuals.
That's interesting. What about the other side of the coin? People who are really empathic, who feel almost like if they see someone crying, they don't just feel like crying, they feel their pain and they start crying. Is it the same kind of neurological function when that happens on the other side?
So this is when our neurons are actually firing better and mirror neurons are probably more profound and more developed. And then particularly there's more neurological response in the empathy centers of our brain, like the anterior cingulate cortex, which is responsible for pain perception. So if we're in pain, like if, for example, if I stab my toe, it's going to hurt me, and the anterior cingulate cortex is going to be activated. But if I saw you stab your toe, and if I'm empathic, that same part of the brain would be activated, the anterior cingulate cortex. So I would, in a sense, understand your pain. Maybe I wouldn't feel it to the same degree, but I'd be able to understand it through empathy. Similar, we have this structure called the insula, which is responsible, among other things, responsible for empathy and love. So when we see someone in pain, the anterior cingulate cortex kicks in, making us experience pain, and then the insula kicks in, allowing us to experience love for that individual, and that's what empathy is. Empathy is pain with love. So when we're able to, actually that would be more compassion. So when we're able to be compassionate toward that individual, we can understand what they're going through, we want to help. We have this loving response toward them. So you were asking about people that maybe take on the pain of others too much. This is called empathic distress. So empathy is a superpower. So empathy is actually an advanced development. In fact, a lot of people know about Charles Darwin and his view of survival of the fittest, but what a lot of people don't know is that he actually wrote a lot about altruism and empathy, and he said that the way that society is most likely to survive is by being altruistic to one another, by us helping each other, and Dalai Lama writes a lot about that too now. So empathy is actually an advanced skill. The problem with empathy is that if we don't know how to kind of hone it and how to use it, we might experience what's called empathic distress. We might become overwhelmed by the feelings of others and not know how to respond to their pain and our pain. So the answer to empathic distress is to be able to both soothe our own pain, that's called self-compassion, and to offer compassion to the person that is struggling. So self-compassion and compassion to the other person.
That's interesting. So, I have some of that. I'm really not. I don't know if it's overly, but I actually really feel for other people. So
that's
if
great.
Someone sometimes sometimes I take on their emotional burdens and I shouldn't, and
mm-hmm.
I know that. But
mm-hmm.
how does someone combat that? I mean, is that something? I don't mean stop being empathetic.
Mm-hmm.
I just mean so it hurts too much inside you, you know?
Yeah. And I think
because you're talking about that.
Yeah. And I think that the answer is really what's called self-compassion. Self-compassion is the antidote to empathic distress. So what you were talking about, like when you see someone else suffering and it becomes too overwhelming, that's called empathic distress, right? You're distressed
mm-hmm.
because of the empathy you're experiencing toward that person. So the first step is to acknowledge your own pain and to notice, hey, I'm suffering. And maybe even ask yourself, what do I need right now? And sometimes even just placing our hands on our heart and giving ourselves a little hug and breathing for a few minutes can reduce some of the empathic distress and kick in our body's mammalian soothing response. So when we put our hands on our heart in a time of struggle, our bodies might release a hormone called oxytocin. This is the cuddle hormone. It's the hormone that's released when we're cuddling someone or when we see a cute little puppy or a kitten. And similar, when we hug ourselves, this hormone can be released. So some people like putting their hands on their hearts. Other people like hugging a pillow, for example. But first and foremost, providing at least a brief amount of support for ourselves so that we can soothe, and then providing support for that individual, of course, barring that anyone is in immediate physical danger. So if the situation permits, giving yourself the support you need first to soothe, to regain your strength, and then to be able to help the other person.
That's interesting. I wonder if that's why when you're upset, you automatically cross your arms across your chest, just because you're just kind of giving yourself a little mini hug to get you through your distress.
That could be. So maybe one of the things that we do is to try to give ourselves that hug, and another could be that maybe we're trying to close ourselves off from what's happening. I think the intention has a lot to do with it. So if we remind ourselves, hey, I'm just going to give myself a hug, that same even like hand crossing can have a very different reaction, can have a very different feel to it, as opposed to, I don't like this, so I'm just going to withdraw.
Mm, okay. So it could be either way.
Yeah.
We have about 7 minutes, and I want to give you time to say how people can get your book, how people can get in touch with you, and if you have any events that you have coming up where people can meet you.
Sure. So my book is currently not available in the United States yet. So it's out in the UK. In the US, it comes out on August 1st. I will be signing advanced copies in New York on June 3rd at BookCon. And then for anyone going to San Diego Comic-Con, Mysterious Galaxy will be hosting advanced sale of copies of my book, and I will be signing at San Diego Comic-Con. And then on August 1st, my books are available everywhere, all major bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and for San Diego locals, Mysterious Galaxy will also be hosting a launch party for Superhero Therapy.
Cool. And how would they get in touch with you if they want to, you know, set up a therapy session or something? Or is that something that they have to do through referrals?
Sure. So I think the easiest way would be to contact me through Psychology Today if someone wants to set up a clinical appointment with me to be seen in therapy with me. If somebody would like to just ask me a couple of questions or find out about my book, they can contact me through my website, superhero-therapy.com. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter. I have professional pages that people can follow and ask me questions through that.
Great. Thank you for coming on the show. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.